I think grapes are probably not so unusual for most people, but probably what's unusual here is where we're trying to grow them. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about doing especially wine grapes in cold climate regions. And this is, as you'll see, this is a very recent industry, but one that's starting to become somewhat sizable here. I also want to especially acknowledge a project that has really helped advance our efforts and our knowledge in cold climate viticulture over the last 4 years. We're entering the fifth year of the Northern Grapes Project, and this was a project, or is a project, funded by USDA Specialty Crops Research Initiative. Involves the various states in the Midwest and the Northeastern United States that you see in the map there, as well as 23 industry associations. And this was really key in that we can use them to both get information and then get information out too. So I'll mention more about this project a little bit later in the presentation, but this has been a really good vehicle to, in the last 4 years, kind of kickstart this new industry a little bit more. First, a little background. The place where we're talking about growing grapes is pretty cold. Now, where I'm from in Minnesota is probably one of the more extreme places, but in the surrounding Midwestern areas, especially, we have an extreme continental climate. Very easy to get to minus 30, very easy to get to minus 30 in the winter, and easy to get to 40 degrees C in the summer. In some of these places, at least. We do, during the growing season, generally get very abundant sunshine and warm conditions, but also often humid conditions, which can make for some disease issues. rainfall is quite variable, but can be in the 600 to 1,000 millimeter per year range, and generally enough so that grapes, once established, don't need too much irrigation, and often none at all. Wide range of soils. Much of this area is glaciated, and this results in different soils being deposited every 100 feet you go sometimes. And in much of the area, not a big range of topography and some very small elevation ranges. This is less true as you get into some of the areas in New England, northern New York, where grapes are being grown, but certainly true in the Midwest. In much of the regions, snow can be abundant. This is our vineyard manager in Minnesota 2 winters ago, looking at the top wire of the trellis from the top as he goes out to try and prune. And this could have been New York, New England last year with their snowfall this past year. So this can be one of the challenges. We don't often see this, but the winter is a real serious challenge for us. Nights at minus 20 to minus 30 are quite typical throughout much of the region. So to kind of summarize, as far as the challenges that we've had in getting the cold, and our growers have had getting cold climate viticulture going, really over the last 40 or 50 years at least, and as I'll show you, it's been even longer. Environmental adaptation, as I mentioned, winter and hardiness. Also, getting a long enough season, and this usually means, especially in the early end, we're bumping up against spring frost to get enough season to ripen grapes properly. Humid conditions especially mean that we have a number of fungal diseases that affect both leaves and clusters of fruit. Also crown gall, phylloxera, both as a root problem and as a leaf problem, as you see in the picture in the middle of the page there. Phenoxy herbicide resistance because of the general agricultural picture with grain growing being so important in much of the region. and then some quality issues too, getting proper acid sugar balances, color, and flavors. Of course, these are problems in any wine growing region and offer some particular problems in cold climate regions. Now, the challenges that I outlined are really more than Vitis vinifera can handle. So in breeders really over the last more than 100 years have gone to our local grape species, our local native grape species, Vitis riparia. You can see the outline of its range in blue there. It's the northernmost occurring grape species in in North America, and you can see many of the other ranges. We are a center of diversity for Vitis. As far as breeding, it's got a number of positive features: the cold hardiness, ability to accumulate high sugar levels in a short season. It's very easy for it to get up to 28 or 30 bricks, even in Minnesota, even in central Minnesota. Resistance to a number of fungal diseases, root phylloxera, and a wide soil tolerance. Number of negative features too, though: high acidity, high pigment, in some cases, strong herbaceous flavors, which in small doses can be intriguing in a wine, but in large doses can be a little bit overwhelming. Small clusters and berries, as you can see in the picture. Early bud break, and this is especially a problem as we take these varieties a little bit further south in the Midwest. A wild growth habit, which is a problem anywhere they're grown, or anywhere some of the varieties derived from them are grown. And then susceptibility to the foliar phase of phylloxera. Now, the history of breeding goes back actually quite a long time in the Midwest. A German immigrant named Louis Swelter developed a variety called Beta by crossing a white riparia, a very rare kind of wild grape, with Concord. And Beta was kind of a rock star of the late 1800s, early 1900s, as far as grape growing in the Midwest and even in some of the colder regions of the East. It matures where Concord doesn't mature for these regions, and also is hardier in the winter than Concord is. There were several 20th century grape breeding programs, starting with Niels Hansen at South Dakota State University. He developed a number of varieties, again, of sort of the Vitis labrusca type, crossed with Vitis riparia. The one that still exists today is actually developed by Ron Peterson. It's Valiant, and that is still grown to some extent today, primarily probably for juice and wine. In the early part of the 20th century, when we had temperance and movement and prohibition, there was a grape breeding program at the University of Minnesota that mainly developed labrusca type hybrids based on Concord and some others for our region in that era. And this produced Bluebell, which is still on the market for us, still grown as a table grape, a juice grape. And Minnesota 78, which was never actually formally released, but became a major parent for the region, primarily through the use of it by Elmer Swenson, who was a private grape breeder, active from about the 1950s to the 2000s, working off of his dairy farm in northwestern Minnesota. He used Minnesota 78 and a few selections of riparia that he made to produce several table grape cultivars primarily, but also some of them were suitable for wine. Elmer himself seldom drank wine, but he always wanted a grape that he could eat from his own farm, and so that was mainly his interest. And then some of his friends tried making wine from them, and some of them worked out for wine too. So that's kind of how his varieties developed. At the University of Minnesota, there was an initial Vitis riparia collection and evaluation effort as part of a master's thesis program, and this yielded several select riparias that were used in further breeding that started in 1978 and continues to the present. So in addition to those riparia selections, we've used a number of the Swenson selections, a number of vinifera cultivars, and then French American hybrids of various sorts. And this pedigree of our variety Marquette kind of gives you some idea of the history and complexity of grape breeding for cold climates. You don't need to obviously read what every ancestor was here, but I've color-coded the species inputs. The breeding of Marquette actually goes back 11 generations and over 100 years, involves six Vitis species. So Vitis vinifera comes in there quite a bit. 60% of the ancestry by pedigree is Vitis vinifera, and that's in purple there, and you see it coming in quite a bit. Vitis riparia has had some real key input, especially towards the top there in recent times. And then there's been a number of American species that are in its pedigree that have provided some of the disease resistance. And the development proceeded in several phases. There was the domestication selection of Vitis riparia, finding the best examples of that to use, done by Swenson and also done by us. also, the French-American breeding done over in France by French hybridizers gave a bulk of the breeding background for this in combining a lot of the different species, of course, primarily for phylloxera and disease resistance. And then our contribution really over about a 20-year period to kind of put all this together to grow to produce Marquette, which is the main variety that we have now for red wine in cold climate areas. So to kind of go over the varieties that are used most commonly, I'm not going to say too much about table grapes. It's a very small part of the industry. Hopefully we'll be growing, but probably only about 2% of grape production, something like that, in the region right now. Most of the interest is on wine. Elmer Swenson's varieties, by far the most important in the region. Several seeded varieties there, Swenson Red, Swenson White, Edelweiss, and Louise Swenson are some of the ones that we see at farmers markets. Some very nice flavors and some firm textures, but of course those nasty seeds that Americans can't seem to get past. He did develop two seedless types that are very nice to eat, some very nice flavor, a softer texture than what we would get from California, but still pretty good. The problem with them is they're not really hardy in zone 4. Zone 5 is about as far north as they can probably go, and even that's probably a little bit dicey some years. So probably more of a garden item rather than a commercial item at this point. Some juice and jelly types, Labrusca types being grown, probably the most important ones are shown here. In much of the region, we can't really ripen Concord and some of the other longer season ones that are grown commonly in the east. And so Beta is still grown. Warden from the east is grown. Bluebell and also Valiant, as I mentioned earlier. And then a rather mysterious one called King of the North, which is a Labrusca, probably a Labrusca riparia type with an origin that we really don't know too much about, but performs quite well. And then wine grapes, which are certainly by far the most acreage in the area. Four cultivars introduced from the University of Minnesota. Marquette would be the most widely planted red wine type. And then for white wines, La Crescent is widely planted. And there's also a further mutation of Frontenac called Frontenac Blanc, which is being widely planted, will probably become one of the most important white varieties, I would guess, within a few years. A number of Swenson varieties are also grown. I've put the most common ones here in terms of what our acreage surveys have shown in the Northern Grapes Project. Brianna, Edelweiss, St. Croix, and St. Pepin are all widely grown, especially Brianna and Edelweiss kind of in the southern part of our region, and then St. Croix more to the north. I put this slide in to give you an idea talk about several things, but give you an idea of how hardy some of these things are. I've got bud survival on the vertical axis there, and these are just means of about 7 or 8 years at our Horticultural Research Center near Twin Cities area of Minnesota. What we do is we sample about 120 buds in the spring, after usually in March, after they've gone through most of the winter cold, slice them open, as you can see in the upper right, and a so-called grape bud or a node actually contains three buds, a primary in the center, which is usually the one that breaks, hopefully, and gives you most of the fruit, a secondary, which will break if the primary is dead, as it is in the case of in this photo here, and then a tertiary, which sometimes breaks. As you can see from the graph, I've got two vinifera varieties there on the right, and those should actually be bars that go down through the bottom of the slide. They would be at 0% bud survival. You can see the primaries of Marcel Foch and Léon Mio survived reasonably well over this period in our location. But then some of the varieties developed by Swenson and by us at the University of Minnesota, you know, do even better. One of the other things I'll point out, though, is that in these varieties, the secondary buds are almost always fruitful. So that's not necessarily true in vinifera. If you lose the primary bud in vinifera, often you get no crop if when the secondary bud breaks. So one of the things breeders have done either by intent or inadvertently has been to select for secondary bud fruitfulness. And so this has been a key part of why we can get still get a crop, even in the cases when we lose some of these primary buds, either to winter cold or to spring frost, too. Okay, another challenge for us has been ripening fruit in a short season. This graph shows soluble solids content, and the black lines there are the vinifera varieties. You can see they start out pretty low as we're at Verizon, and then get up to reasonable levels in the low 20s for most of them. You can see then that the various cold climate grapes, they're in all the various colors there, generally have no trouble by the end of the year reaching that 20 to 25 Brix. So sugar accumulation, at least in our climate here, and this is over, I think, four years, in Minnesota, has not been a problem for us. What has been more of a problem is acidity. And again, you can see here the dark lines are vinifera. They start high, but they go down to a very reasonable level, under 10 grams per liter. Many of the cold climate varieties stay above 10 grams, which is kind of damaging on the mouth and requires and limits the kind of wines we can make. Usually they have to have some sugar, some residual sugar remaining to balance out that acidity. So this just points out the acidity problem with three of our cold climate varieties on the top, three vinifera on the bottom. Basically what you can see is that the cold climate varieties have a higher total acidity, and most of this is due to a higher malic acid content. The malic just doesn't go down at the same pace that the tartaric acid does. Now, the Northern Grapes Project, one of the first things we did was to see what is the state of this industry. It's a rapidly emerging industry across the northern states, and so a baseline survey was done by our economics team in 2011, found that there were 5,900 acres. 40% of that was non-bearing. So if you think about that, 2011, in 2000, let's say 16 next year, that means probably 2,500 or more acres that will be bearing that weren't around 5 years ago. So the thing is rapidly exploding. Also, 80% of it planted just since 2002, which means that most of it's only been bearing since about 2006 or so and later. Wineries now up to 300 at that point in time, 80% of them established since 2002. Again, a young industry. I'll point out in the state of Iowa here, just to give you a state example, how this has looked, giving you on the left there some figures comparing 1999, which was kind of the start of the boom, to 2014, going from 30 to 1,200 acres of grapes, 10 to 100 wineries. And in the 20-teens here, production has reached about 120,000 cases or more, with some big dips there, which are the effects of weather. Economic impact back in 2011 overall was estimated at about $401 million across the states, these northern states where it was surveyed. This is a combination of the value of the grapes, which is relatively minimal compared to the value added in the winery, and then the associated tourism. So our grape and wine industry is really a wine-themed tourism business. We also gathered some information on our clientele in the region, the growers and winemakers. They're very enthusiastic. They are, for the most part, part-timers. They have day jobs that they have to balance and often supplement their income while they're trying to make income with winery. They're still developing skills, both in growing grapes and making wine. They often have no detailed business plan. They sort of stumble into it and stumble into getting bigger. They're very receptive to technical information. They want to know more. Often these are very bright people who've been successful in other fields. However, they're also receptive to a lot of folklore and hearsay. And they're inordinately fond of certain practices. One here is the vertical shoot position training system, which leads to a lot of manual effort and some low yields, too. So the basis for the Northern Grape Project was that we had some new cultivars, some unique fruit chemistry, novice people in the industry. And so we developed it, the approach then, to look at varietal performance, get some better data on varietal performance, on appropriate viticultural practices for some of these varieties, on appropriate winemaking practices for the varieties, and then trying to understand, since most of this wine is being sold out the front door or by mail order, essentially, try to understand a little more about marketing and consumer preferences. So really, four areas: the vine, the vineyard, the wines, and where we sell the wine. So in several areas there, the cultivar performance is mainly being coordinated through a project that was already underway. This is the NE1020 coordinated variety trials, which were going on in several states, and Tim Martinson, our project director, is helping to coordinate getting some of the data in and reporting that data for the varieties. There's also, in terms of variety performance, a part of the project that looks more at how the grapes develop. And this involves looking at particular varieties. I've got Frontenac and Marquette there at the top. From the time when we're at veraison or color change through harvest, and looking at development of flavors, of sugars and acids, obviously, but of some of the other flavors, using HPLC, GC, and also sensory panels, and then looking at the associated transcriptomes at various times so that we can perhaps get some indicators of what's important and when it's important, both for breeding and potentially for managing viticultural practices, too. On the viticulture side, effort is going into a number of studies in a number of different states on training systems for these varieties. What are the appropriate cropping levels? How do they respond to different cropping levels? And canopy management practices. We have a multi-state nutrition component to this study, trying to determine whether these kind of varieties have any different nutritional parameters than most of what's reported, which has been developed either for vinifera cultivars or for Concord, frankly. So that's another component. And then disease management. We find this is an area where many of our growers kind of fall behind. What control measures do we have? When should they be applied? And where do we also have injury problems potentially from things like copper, as shown in the picture here? On the enology side, I mentioned acid was a big problem, and so a big part of the enology project is looking at how to reduce acid. One of the most promising features has been with some of the new wine strains new yeast strains that have been selected that convert at least part of the malic acid to lactic acid, so that we're not totally reliant on the bacterial malolactic so-called fermentation that has traditionally been used both for vinifera wines and for these wines. So that's looking very promising. Yeast selections to bring out flavors for these particular cultivars. And then what are the wine styles that fit the cultivars? From table wines to sparkling wines, dessert wines, which varieties are suitable for which kind of wines. And then there's a big component with our economics team on consumers. Getting some of that baseline information was part of it. Also tasting room attributes and marketing attributes. What do they respond to? Since these are mostly local consumers, what are they looking for in the wines that they're coming and buying at the winery? It may be very different than what they are looking for when they go to the supermarket. Branding. What should be put on the label? What should not be put on the label? What should be emphasized on the label? Maybe even if it's required, what should go in big print? What should go in little print? This is another thing that we're looking at, too. And then value of collaboration, things such as wine trails. The value of that is being explored by our economics team as well. And then our leader, Tim Martinson, of course, really wanted this to be an extension-based project, and I think that's really essential for the stage that the industry is at right now to basically try to get some of this information out. So there's a huge outreach component to the project. A lot of that's coordinated by Chris Partica, who's in the audience today here. Chris Lynn's done a great job on some of the things I'll be talking about here. Each year we have a Northern Grape Symposium where we share our findings. It's usually held in one of the states in conjunction with another event. Chris Lynn puts out the Northern Grapes News, 4 issues per year, and that's available at the Northern Grapes Project website, as is the as are the 8 per year News You Can Use outputs that we try to get out in a sort of timely way. Northern Grapes Enterprise Workshops, those are on the calendar. We try to publicize them to the various members through the groups that we work with, include field days and workshops for the winemakers. And then probably what's been the most popular has been the webinar series. And I think we may be up to about 26 webinars now. I'm not sure what the number is. We generally have about 50 to 150 people live on each broadcast, and then they are archived at the Northern Grapes website. And then our final big push for the last year of the project here is construction of what we sort of call the user's manual in the project, basically getting all the information that we know about these varieties that we've found from our research into a format that is going to be available. So with that, I'd like to acknowledge our many partners. You can see our many partnering organizations in the Northern Grapes Project, and of course Tim Martinson at Cornell, who leads the project, Chris Lynn, who manages the project here, and our many collaborators, and then my collaborators at the University of Minnesota. So thank you very much. Okay, so the question I think is mainly about growing vinifera grapes when people shouldn't be. Across the northern tier, that pretty much gets taken care of the first winter. Maybe not so much for you guys. You know, you may struggle a little bit. I haven't been to Oklahoma. I've been to northern Texas and Panhandle area where people try this too. And for us, they find out very quickly that they just don't make it, and unless they actually bury the vines, which is what we do to get vinifera through, they just don't make it through. We hit minus 10 Fahrenheit easily each year in our region, for example. Much of the upper Midwest does, in northern Great Plains. And so that gets taken care of pretty quickly. A lot of folks, many of you folks work with growers. Some people just don't want to hear the message, and they have to find out themselves. So, Doc Clark.
Well, Dr. Libby, I was curious, as I've mentioned to you, recent years, I didn't say this to you early on, when I thought this was a crazy idea you had to go out in the bushes and collect Fraparia and make a product and not have the lifetime length of Moses. Has this gone much better than you thought it had now that you kind of look back on when you started going from the introgressing these wild types into your products?
Yeah, I think, it's benefited a lot. Well, fortunately, we did get some varieties that work reasonably well, not that they don't have problems. I think they benefited from coming along at the right time. As you notice there, from like 2002 to 2011, there's just massive growth. That's kind of when people got a little more interested in the food that they eat. They got a little more interested in local. In the last years, millennials have become more important as part of our consumer base and are not and they don't feel constrained by some of the same things that old folks like us feel constrained about as far as where their wine should come from, what it should taste like. And so I think that's helped too. So I find in the class I teach, for example, in Minnesota, when we do wines made from these grapes, they're very young, you know, the young students are very curious about these wines, and they don't really care that they don't taste like a Burgundy or a Bordeaux exactly, you know. And so I think we're also seeing that change. So part of it is just changing times. Part of it is we got something that works pretty well, at least, and hopefully we'll get some better ones.
Well, let's thank Dr. Luby.
Okay, thank you.